Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last month, Commander Chanel Dickerson of the Washington Metropolitan Police Department's Youth and Family Services Division wanted to draw attention to missing girls in the area. So she created the hashtag #MissingDCGirls and started posting their missing persons profiles to the police department's Twitter page. The posts went viral immediately, sparking public outcry over the perceived surge in missing girls and lack of media attention paid to finding them. The majority of these girls were Black and Latina. Local residents turned out for a town hall meeting. It was standing room only, and the Congressional Black Caucus called for a federal investigation. But according to the Metro PD, there is no spike in missing girls. At a news conference last month, Dickerson said, without minimizing the number of missing persons in D.C., because one missing person is one person too many, there's actually been a decrease. There is always a concern of human trafficking, but we have no evidence for this. Well, the controversy has sparked a conversation about how race and class affect the response police and the media have to crimes, victims, and youth who run away. Because the police said most of those girls actually ran away from home. But the question is, why? Black children represent a disproportionate number of reported missing persons. Nearly 40% of missing persons under 18 are Black, according to the FBI 2016 data. Minors account for 70% of missing person reports, and more than 50% are girls. To discuss this today, I'm joined by three guests. Monique Morris is founder and president of the National Black Women's Justice Institute and an adjunct associate professor at St. Mary's College of California. Monique is an award-winning scholar and author of three books, including Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. Monique is also an appointed member of the U.S. Department of Justice's National Girls Initiative Expert Panel. Hi, Monique. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me on again.
Great to have you back. We're also joined by Margaret Prescott, founder of the Black Coalition Fighting Back Serial Murders and the host of Pacifica Radio's Sojourner Truth. Hi, Margaret. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And we're joined by Amba Johnson. Amba is director of Dreamcatcher Youth Services, an agency serving homeless and trafficked youth in both their shelter and support center. For the last 17 years, Amba has worked with commercially sexually exploited youth. Dreamcatcher Youth Services is the only shelter in Alameda and Contra Costa counties serving homeless and trafficked youth 13 to 18 years old. Hi, Amba. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah. Hi. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you all for joining us. This is a conversation that really needs to happen, and this is getting quite a bit of media attention, but I feel like it's not there. Most of the stories aren't really going in depth, and if in fact these girls ran away from home, which is what the police said in D.C., a lot of these articles aren't talking about why these girls ran away from home. So, Monique, I want to start off with you. First off, what do you make of how this story unfolded last month?
Well, I mean, I thought it was interesting that people were beginning to acknowledge that Black girls also go missing. And there was obviously a deep concern about the underlying issues associated with why Black girls are disproportionately represented among those who are classified as runaways, disproportionately represented among those who are classified as missing, and yet there hasn't really been a national discourse or really public outcry, which is what people were wanting to see when Black girls go missing. In many ways, I felt that the conversation unfolded from and was really coming from the same frustration that many have felt in association with the invisibility of Black girl trauma and the erasure of Black girls from conversations about risk and victimization. And so in many ways, you know, the conversation developing about, you know, the lack of response, the absence of there really being a critical discussion about why this is occurring, and even when people found out that there wasn't necessarily a surge in the number of missing Black girls, but, you know, rather a consistent you know, invisibility of missing Black girls, there was still a deep concern that I feel warrants an investigation and just a public interrogation of how we value black girl lives, how we respond to black girl trauma, how we, and whether we, you know, will commit to seeing them as people worthy of our concern.
Margaret, back in the 1980s in South Los Angeles, more than a dozen black women were murdered, and you founded the Black Coalition Fighting Back Serial Murders. You were among a few to actually go door to door to warn community members about black women being murdered in South Los Angeles, and we'll talk about that in just a couple minutes. You have years of experience dealing with this issue. What really strikes you about how this story unfolded last month?
Well, I think it was another example of the kind of devaluation that our former the guest prior to me spoke about, of the lives not only of black girls but of black women. When we founded the coalition back in the mid-1980s, the Black Coalition Fighting Back Serial Murders, our slogan was "Black women's lives count," right? And if you fast forward that to the Black Lives Matter movement today, you could see, you know, very much it was a precursor of that. And the, you know, I really do see the connection and the relationship between the story of the disappearances of so many black girls, not only in Washington, D.C., young black women, but across the nation, because it does get very little attention. And when it comes to the murders, and we hope that all of the missing girls are all alive and in one piece. But when black women are murdered in the series that happened here in Southern California, even that doesn't get the much attention from law enforcement, from the media, and the general public usually knows very little about it.
And Monique, just going back to you quickly, what also struck me about the reporting is that it seemed like there were two lines of thinking. One was that social media completely got it wrong. Shame on them for putting out a lot of misinformation. And then you had a lot of activists saying, well, the police said that these girls ran away. Now we need to talk about why they're actually running away. We can't just say, oh, they're not missing. They're just runaways. So let's move on now.
That's right. And again, that's what I mean when I talk about the erasure of black girl trauma and how I was really proud of social media for stepping up and really trying to hold us all accountable to a conversation that needs to take place. That you know, many advocates have been in the streets trying to respond to, and in our homes, you know, African American communities tend to acknowledge, particularly when there are Amber Alerts and there are other efforts to reclaim girls who are not African American, or who, when there is a concerted media attention to missing girls of other racial and ethnic groups, and yet we know that there are girls who are missing. We know that there is a tendency to dismiss their absence as a conscious choice and a way in which there has been a conflation of coercion and choice when it comes to black girls and black women. And so there, I think, was an opportunity for us that I hope many will continue to take advantage of to really begin to hold all of us accountable to that kind of conversation.
Time magazine pointed to a 2016 analysis of online coverage of missing persons published in the Journal of Criminal Law and Criminology, and it found evidence that cases involving white women not only draw more attention, but more intense coverage. And the late PBS journalist Gwen Ifill once dubbed this phenomenon the missing white woman syndrome. And Amba, I wanted to ask you, because you're director of Dreamcatcher Youth Services. This is an agency serving homeless and trafficked youth in Alameda County, to talk about what we need to learn about runaways, for example, because the commander in Washington, D.C. said we need to get to the bottom of why these young people feel that there's no alternative but to leave home. And in the New York Times, author Morgan Jenkins writes that claims that black girls leave home voluntarily, if not coupled with an examination of all the reasons they might feel the need to leave, encourage the public to see black girls not as children in need of protection, but adults responsible for their own predicament. And as a result, few in authority do anything for them. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I had worked about 20 years with trafficked youth and trafficked girls,
And when I came to this current position, part of it was a homeless shelter, and I started wondering what the relationship was and who these youth were. And what I found was that the delineation, first of all, between trafficked and non-trafficked youth, when you're talking about homeless youth, is a very vague line. If youth are out of the home, I can assure you that within a very short amount of time, they're being exploited in one way or another. The other frustration I had was exactly that when I would speak about homeless youth, the response would be an assumption of culpability, like they had a choice and they made a bad choice. You know, even if it was tough there, they could have done something else. Even if this was going on or that was going on, surely they could have gone somewhere else. And all of those assumptions are profoundly inaccurate. Most girls, all the girls, in fact, that we have worked with have left home because of some degree of trauma and immediate or danger within a time frame that they have to make a choice to go, or they are reacting to a complex accumulation of trauma, both in the home and, I would argue, in general societally, that overwhelms them. And they don't have options. They do go to the street because there are no options. Homeless youth go to the street because I tell people all the time, like, nobody runs away from home because they lost their cell phone. It doesn't happen. Like, they don't get grounded and then they're like, I'm out of here, I'd rather go get risk death. Like, that isn't the choice we make. That isn't the choice they make. But they also are fighting a socialization that happens in media and a socialization that happens on the street that suggests that transactional sex is more acceptable for them, more has a value for them, presents a value to them, which is just, it's kind of horrifically false. But I watch the teens coming up that are desperate for choices and not seeing that they have choices, accepting that this is their only option is once they're on the street, that they have to be vulnerable to the people exploiting them, with very little discussion of who's exploiting them and why they're exploiting them, and the fetishization of black girls, the connection of black girls from very young ages to being sexualized, over-sexualized, accepted that it's sexualized. When I was a child welfare worker, when youth went missing, I didn't understand why the FBI wasn't notified, why there was no Amber Alert, and I began to realize it was because it had everything to do with the fact that they were youth of color.
Hmm. In one piece in the Washington Post, April Thomas, a 34-year-old, talked about how her 12-year-old had run away from the family's home about 5 times. And she said that the police would say, oh, your daughter's run away again? She said the last disappearance was the most serious. Her daughter left school and was not found until days later, holed up in an abandoned apartment with other juveniles. And at that point, she just said that the police were used to it and they didn't take it seriously. Margaret, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, 75% of runaways are females, and the leading reasons for this are family problems, transitioning from foster care, economic issues. What changes would you like to see so we can actually address these issues? Margaret? Did we lose Margaret? Let's go to Monique with that one.
Yeah, no, I'm back. Sorry about that.
Oh, okay.
I think we have to look at what is happening in, let's start with the child welfare system, because at least one of the stories I read about the D.C. situation, there was a young woman who talked about being abused in foster care. I'm glad that you mentioned foster care, because so many children are being taken, black and brown children in particular, are removed from their homes, not necessarily because they are abused, but because their families are poor, because of impoverishment. And then it's very difficult for those families to be united again. And then social workers and family courts are on overload, so they're not really able to pay attention to the homes where children really are being abused and are in need of assistance. So I think there are some changes that have to be made there, and look at some of the cities, like in Chicago, that has managed to, because of changes in policies, to make a drop then in families that are not united, right, and bring those families together. So I think that that is one area. I think we're also underestimating poverty as violence and trauma, because you, just from the point of view of a mother, I was a single mother for many years, and an impoverished single mother. It's an extremely stressful situation, and I'm sure that that stress then carries on to our children. In fact, there have been studies related to that. So there's trauma within the family. I don't think that we could sidestep the economic issues. Not that those are some of the only problems, because there are issues of sexual abuse that goes on and physical and emotional abuse. But I think we tend to underestimate that kind of societal cause, so to speak, of some of these problems. So I think I'm glad that people are paying more attention to this and talking to young people, to young women and black girls in particular, to find out what it is that they are going through, why the reasons are that they're running away. And in some communities of color, in Native American communities, you, for example, you see a very high rate of suicide.
Yep.
Young people are really in trouble, and we have to be accountable and take some responsibility as a society for why that is, and the role that systemic racism and the devaluation of the lives of some of us, as opposed to others of us, play in all of this. I mean, in the serial murders story in South Los Angeles, we have 200 black women missing, as many as 100 perhaps victims of a serial killer, but this is not national news. When one white blonde college student goes missing, the whole world knows about it. It's true that she should get the attention, the young white woman that goes missing, but the same should happen also for black girls, for black women, for people of color, and this kind of not only stereotype, but the double standard that is race-based has got to end.
Monique, what would you add?
I would just say that we communicate in different ways about what's important to us, and in a conversation that I was part of in New York City recently, Monifa Bandele said something brilliant that I want to share now, and that was that silence and erasure is violence in some cases. And I think that's exactly what we've been seeing on this issue, is the manifestation of various forms of violence, including the poverty and structural violence that was just shared, but in addition to that, really, the silence and erasure of black women and girls in this conversation as a form, an additional form of violence, that also sends a message to other black women and girls about where they sit in terms of this nation's priorities, how well they will be protected in conversations and policies and practices associated with their well-being, and the extent to which they come to understand their function in society. I think many of the issues that have been raised already in this conversation around the early priming of black girls for victimization, the fetishization that impacts them, the ways in which there's a belief of hypersexualization that renders their trauma invisible, all these things really come together when we say, when we begin to organize and think about how we want to respond to girls that are missing, and the way in which that might inform how we determine the cause of them going missing, and whether we think that's important for our whether we think that's even a story, whether we think it's even something that's newsworthy, whether we think it's something that's worthy of our time and interrogation and organizing efforts. All these things really play a part in how we come to terms with the prevailing consciousness that erases black girls and women in this space. The other thing that I would want to just add is that in many ways, this priming that we're talking about shows up not just in the media. The media is the easy target on this because, you know, they share and report the news. But there are other institutions where these girls and women go missing from that, again, are underreported and not a part of the national discourse on these issues, schools being one of them. Mm-hmm. You know, when I first heard this story, immediately I thought, you know, if these girls were missing, you know, were they captured as chronically truant? Were there early signs that we could have responded to? The same when girls are trafficked. You know, there are many institutions that could play a better, stronger role in a collective community effort designed to respond to the crisis in our communities. And it's not something that is just about, you know, these families in need, quote unquote, which is another way to dismiss the relevance of people in pain in these spaces, but it's a way for us to think about the rigor of our institutions with respect to how we respond to all children, how we respond to all communities that may be in a moment of crisis, and whether we are connected enough institutionally, connected enough in our work to identify and quickly respond to these conditions. Because we like to think of police as first responders, but really those who are working with these populations, with these women and girls on a daily basis, they are the first responders in many ways and could play a different role, really, in responding to their crises.
Monique Morris is founder and president of the National Black Women's Justice Institute. Amba Johnson is director of Dreamcatcher Youth Services. Margaret Prescott is founder of the Black Coalition Fighting Back Serial Murders. And Margaret, I know we have to let you go in a couple minutes, but I just wanted to ask you about what you went through back in the 80s when in South Los Angeles, more than a dozen black women were murdered. And at that time, there was very little press coverage or even public warnings from the LAPD. And so you and a few others decided to go door to door to warn community members about this. And it's shocking to learn that the man who was doing this was just convicted last August. Lonnie David Franklin Jr., also known as the Grim Sleeper, was sentenced to death for murdering women as far back as the 80s. So just in the next couple of minutes, can you tell us what prompted you to start knocking on doors and what kind of response did you get?
Well, what prompted was the outrage that the Los Angeles Police Department waited until 11 women were already victims to announce that a serial killer was operating in South Los Angeles. South Los Angeles is not a huge area. And I was stunned because I knew very well that if one victim was murdered in, let's say, Beverly Hills or an affluent area, that it would have been all over the news. LAPD, the police and other law enforcement would have been all over it. So I called some friends together. We went down to police headquarters to see, well, what is being done? Is the community being informed? Community meetings organized? And we were told by the sergeant in charge, well, why are you concerned? He's only killing hookers.
Wow.
And that just outraged us even more because the kind of attitude that we found out there was a slang in law enforcement called NHI, no humans involved. So that when there was a murder of a drug addict or a prostitute, you know, someone that people don't care that much about, that they're referred to as NHI and they're not a high priority. But these are women murder were some mother's daughter, some father's child. All of them, by the way, who were murdered in this series were all mothers with the exception of 14-year-old Princess Bartholomew. So it was a very emotional time for us. Going way back in the mid-1980s when we founded the coalition and had no idea that decades later we still would be addressing this problem and making the same case. There's still a number of women missing. There were 35 of the hundreds of photos found in Lonnie Franklin's home that we don't know where they are.
Wow.
So we're still out in the community giving out flyers with their photos. We don't have their names, hoping that someone will recognize them. But yet again, it's falling under the radar. across movements, I must say. And it continues to be a painful challenge for those of us who are working on this, for the family members and the children who've been left behind.
And again, Lonnie David Franklin Jr., known as the Grim Sleeper, was sentenced to death for murdering women as far back as the 80s last August. What are your thoughts on why it took so long to solve this case?
I think the reasons are the issues that I mentioned before, that this was not a high priority for LAPD. There were mistakes that were made, and some of which were chronicled in the film Tales of the Grim Sleeper that played on an HBO film. I tell you, we would need a few hours for me to just go through with you all of what should have happened that did not happen. A 911 call that wasn't released for 20 years when somebody might have recognized the voice. Many people thought that was the voice of the killer. A woman who was attacked and survived, was left for dead and survived, took LAPD two doors down from where Lonnie Franklin was found several decades later, because he had made a stop at that particular home. She was off by just two homes. So we still have a lot of questions about what went wrong, why it took so long, why this happened, and also what is being done now to actively pursue and find the women who remain missing. So sadly, I wasn't surprised when I saw the story of the D.C. missing girls, because it just seems part of the same syndrome, really, where the lives of some of us are valued less than the lives of others of us. And I think that's something that all of us, whatever community we're from, whatever racial background we're from, have to pay attention to, because Lonnie Franklin was found guilty of murder of black women in South Los Angeles, but there was a white woman over in Germany that he and some of his buddies brutally raped. So often you start with one population, like sex workers, and eventually you go on to other women. So this is something that's of concern for all of us.
You know, this concept that you raised around no human involved is one that I think we should spend a little more time on, even if it's just a few more seconds, because I think that, you know, to have this conversation outside of the historical context in which black identity was shaped in America, you know, just feels incomplete, because we have to acknowledge that a lot of the consciousness that we're describing with respect to how we shape our own responses to missing girls in D.C. is situated in a much broader context of how Africans were brought into this conversation, into this country, how there was a dehumanization of being of brown skin that continues in our unconscious engagement with black identity, as well as our conscious engagement with black identity. And so it's not to say that responses to missing black girls was intentionally racist, but it is to say that there has been a deep undercurrent and almost, you know, sometimes not even so covert expression or understanding of black identity as not human. And so to have, you know, a state agency or a representative of the state declare that no human was involved in a murder when it is black and brown bodies is deeply troubling. That should be deeply concerning to all of us. And reflective in many ways, or provide an opportunity for reflection on how we come to understand black identity, even in our unconscious language, even in our everyday interactions. Yes, this was the 80s, but it's not that long ago. Mm-hmm. And so when we think about the ways in which our own understanding of who these individuals are and whether we engage them as human beings, whether we provide them with the same dignity and responses as those we unquestionably mark as human, is all a part of this conversation. You know, I've spent a year now sort of traveling the country declaring in various spaces that black girls and women are sacred and loved. And it's very interesting to see how in some spaces that's accepted as, of course, they're sacred and loved. And in other spaces it's, oh, why do we have to say black women are sacred and loved? And in many ways, it's, you know, sort of the same conversation that people have with the Black Lives Matter movement, where there's a rejection of a declaration of love and appreciation for a particular population that has had a very unique dehumanization experience in this nation that requires us to have conversations like this one about how we classify humanity, how we respond to their humanity, and what part of a prevailing consciousness of dehumanization still lives in our own practices and understanding about who is worthy of our protection and whose victimization and trauma we see and respond to.
Margaret, quick response, and then we'll let you go.
Well, yes, I absolutely agree with that. I mean, we cannot separate this phenomenon from the historic context. And I'll have to say that the murders that Lonnie Franklin was found guilty of happened in the mid-1980s. But some also happened in 2000, and frankly speaking, the even members of law enforcement think that there are a lot more victims than that. We have tracked 200 women who are missing. So as far as black women in South Los Angeles, as far as we're concerned, this is still an issue that is going on. The attitude of no humans involved, that is all too prevalent, sadly, among some, not all, in law enforcement. And I agree, it's something that's very shocking when people hear it, that you sometimes they don't even believe it, but it does happen to be true. And I think I'm glad that this tour is happening about love and appreciation for black girls. One of the things that we're working on is to get a permanent memorial for the victims in South Los Angeles, something that's very distinguished, a bronze, because these women may be lost, but they are not forgotten. We will never forget them. And we also have to remember all of the children that have been left behind and all of the girls, but also the black women, of whom there are hundreds at least missing across the United States. And I hope that what happened in Washington, D.C., the social media attention that it has gotten, will also garner interest in the women who are missing, in the victims who have been murdered, in the phenomenon of no humans involved, and that when we talk about Say Her Name, that the names of all of these victims are also included, and we cannot discard our sisters because they ended up on the streets, because they ran away, because they were perhaps caught upon drugs, because they were sex workers. There are human beings whose lives must be valued. There's some mother's daughter, some father's child, and we are responsible for them. They are us, and we will never forget them.
Margaret Prescott is the host of Pacifica Radio's Sojourner Truth. She's also founder of the Black Coalition Fighting Back Serial Murders. In the 80s, Margaret went door to door to warn community members about black women being murdered in South Los Angeles. More than a dozen black women were murdered then. And just this last August, Lonnie David Franklin, known as the Grim Sleeper, was sentenced to death for murdering those women. Margaret, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you also for bringing up Native American women. We're going to do a separate show about that issue. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
And coming up after the break, we'll continue our conversation about how race and class affect how police and the media respond to missing girls and women of color and runaways with Monique Morris, founder and president of the National Black Women's Justice Institute, and Amba Johnson, director of Dreamcatcher Youth Services in Contra Costa and Alameda counties. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org, and you can also tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, new to the KLW lineup, On Point from WBUR in Boston with your host, Tom Ashbrook. Today, more on the bizarre developments with United Airlines and that controversial video. On Point, coming up at 11.
This is Your Call. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with T.R. Reid about his new book, A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. He says the tax code is overstuffed with loopholes, which don't work out for anyone except lawyers, accountants, the wealthy, and corporations. So we'll be talking about what an equitable tax system would look like. And then Friday, it's our media roundtable. Today, we are talking about how race and class affect how police, the media, and really society respond to missing girls and women of color and runaways. And today we're joined by Monique Morris, founder and president of the National Black Women's Justice Institute, author of three books, including Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. And we had Monique on our show talking about that specifically. You can search for it at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Umba Johnson, director of Dreamcatcher Youth Services, an agency serving homeless and trafficked youth in their shelter and support centers in Alameda and Contra Costa counties. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. If you heard about the missing DC girls last month, what did you make of the response and then the fallout? Because it got a lot of media attention. So what did you make of that? And what are your thoughts on how the media and law enforcement handle missing persons cases? 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Umba, let's talk a little bit more about how you want the conversation about runaways to change. Can you talk just a little bit about what strikes you about how runaways get covered in the media and how you'd like to see that change?
Well, I think that one of my frustrations has been for a while now that when we started to have a public conversation about trafficking, we did not have a public conversation at the same level about homelessness, even though 80% of all youth that are trafficked, girls that are trafficked, were homeless when they were homeless when they became connected to a trafficker. So, I think it should be a consistent conversation. And the reason I believe that the two are separated is because we have now recognized it to some degree that trafficking, there's victimization, and in homelessness, there's an assumption that there isn't victimization, which is inaccurate. Within 72 hours of being on the street, any child is doing some form of transactional exchange of their body in order to survive. And it's only a short walk from there to the point where an exploiter catches them or they're caught in an exploitation cycle with the people they're with. So, you know, that's concerning to me, and I think it comes back to assumption of culpability. But I would also say that trafficking really gives us a story. 70% demographically of the United States is white. 70% of all the youth and girls that are trafficked are black. Wow. So that's, there couldn't be a simpler demonstration of the overrepresentation. It isn't even humanly possible. And the other thing I find about that is that even within the trafficking, there's still a handoff where it's really horrible and let's figure out who's to blame, and the handoff is to black men, which is beyond inaccurate and provides no analysis of what's happening on the street at all. The reality is that the industry is driven by middle-class white men, that the exploitation is driven by middle-class white male dollars. So without that, and that is always stated out of conversations, which I think is such a loud voice of what the problem is all the way along. And with the youth that I see coming in, the panic that we always have is, can we get them before someone else does? They have not left home of their own volition. They do not know what to do. They are stranded out there, and we discount them. When I was a child welfare worker, there was no missing persons report when a youth disappeared off a case. the standard practice at that time was, and I think it still is at least around here, is that the case is held open for a year. If they don't hear from the youth, the case is banked, which means that no notification has gone out to anyone. Now, I know people are struggling to change it in Alameda County, but the reality is that they are so undervalued as a population in that area of social services that they're just written off, like it, because it is seen that if they've left, somehow it's their fault, which is completely the opposite of the truth. First of all, they weren't removed from the home because it was their fault. Second of all, if they're not stable in a system, that is not their fault either. That is the trauma within the system that is overwhelming them. So for me, working on the day-to-day basis with the kids that are coming in, it's very painful to see trafficking become a hot issue, in my opinion, partially because it's a prurient issue. There's sex involved. There's sexual discussion involved. There's sexual connection to the girls involved. And then we hit the airways. But that still doesn't recognize the fact that the girls were homeless first. We were not in the same panic mode day one as we are when it becomes a more fascinating discussion. And that is a huge pain point, I think, for all of us in the field.
And this is happening in Alameda County, California.
It's happening all over the United States.
That's right.
It's certainly happening in California, but it's happening all over the United States. We are one of the largest areas for trafficking of children, but we are not, by any stretch of the imagination, the only one. It is a epidemic within the U.S., and it is an international epidemic, and even internationally, it is women of color.
I said that because I'm assuming that, or people would assume that in a place like Alameda, that these cases would actually go somewhere, that maybe the girls would be treated a little differently because it's Alameda County, for example.
I would say, I mean, the one thing I have to say is that I think that Oakland has led the nation in attempting to have an effective response to trafficking, and they've done incredible things, and we are way ahead of the curve in terms of our response and the systems that have been developed. That's true, and again, that's trafficking.
What is
different? The same level of response doesn't exist to the homeless youth that need to be gotten to safety prior to exploitation. We have 8 beds in our current shelter. We're moving into a larger shelter and adding 8 beds for in a specialized shelter for commercially sexually exploited girls that are trying to leave the street or leaving the street. That is 16 beds within 2 counties for youth under 18 that are primarily, almost exclusively, youth of color, 70%, 80%. And we're not, even in Alameda County, really aggressively responding until after there is an exploitation.
How many beds do you need?
I mean, there's no estimate. We've got about 1,500 youth on the street any given night that don't have a place to stay within our county, and then Contra Costa County lost their only shelters for youth under 18, so really we're the only one in 2 counties. So now we're definitely up over a count of 2,000. We serve about 100 youth a year in the shelter, 200 more in our drop-in center that are destabilized, so that's the proportions. I think that the more down and up the line that we have smaller shelter responses scattered throughout counties and cities, and the more youth know where to go when the home fails them and they are brought to safety immediately, and the girls are brought to safety immediately because they are the most vulnerable of all, the better we will be. But we're not anywhere near there, and part of that is that all the money that is in the big discussions in terms of nonprofits and social services is being directed to the after exploitation, where, again, the story's more interesting, it's more provocative. And one of the things that I saw with that was that when trafficking was first being brought up in a desperate effort to get the country and the audiences to pay attention, I would always hear people that were trying to talk about trafficking for the first time say, it cuts across all classes, it cuts across all racial lines. And really what they were doing was a very pragmatic attempt to engage white populations of funders in a connection to the value of the problem, and the fact that they had to do that speaks volumes about what the entire tragedy of the situation is.
Monique, have you had similar experiences?
Absolutely. And again, I want to situate this in, you know, our historical memory, right?
Yeah.
And talk a bit about how, especially in framing the conditions of black people, W.E.B. Du Bois talked about the talented 10th as the 10% of African Americans that were high performing and high achieving and highly visible to white America. But he also talked about the submerged 10th. And that submerged 10th is the 10% of people who are largely dismissed in our nation as criminals, as people worthy of being disposed of in ways that we wouldn't necessarily think would be acceptable were we to fully examine and accept their humanity. I think the conversation about homelessness is right on point. And we have to talk about the crisis of housing alongside the crisis of exploitation, alongside the crisis of dehumanization that comes together to render a specific vulnerability to girls of color, disproportionately black girls, who are, again, primed for victimization and are exploited in ways that are not really, I guess, deeply interrogated by our public in meaningful ways. I do think that sometimes people listen to this and say, that's just too big for me to deal with, right? When you hear the numbers of over 2,000 kids in need of beds and you think of the number of kids who are living in crisis and girls who are running away and exploited by gangs, exploited by individuals, sometimes out on the street themselves and alone. And, you know, I want to just, you know, just say that one person is too many, and the more of those, you know, individual numbers that we get increases the risk of harm. But we have to commit to starting somewhere, and we have to commit to starting with the idea that these girls are worthy of our investment. These girls are not disposable. That the many of the young people that we see who are exploited, who are running away, who are vulnerable to harm on the street, are also young people who are queer identified. Who some of them are trans girls in transition. Some of them have been rejected from families and homes and whole communities because of their identities and modes of expressions. That intimate partner violence and domestic violence is also a part of this conversation and has to be part of our critical interrogation of the structures and systems that come together to make young people vulnerable to this. And that there are a host of organizations that are responding to these issues, but we can't do it if the public is not also critically engaged in elevating the importance of trauma and victimization in this conversation, and a recognition that it impacts girls of color, disproportionately black girls, in unique ways. So, you know, I think the many intersections, you know, that we're able to highlight in this conversation are in many ways just the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I want to encourage folks not to become overwhelmed with the statistics, but to see these as opportunities for us to enter somewhere along this continuum of vulnerability for our girls and to work with our girls.
Right.
I think one of the most successful practices is to really rely on the voices of survivors and to really engage with those who are living this experience, who are struggling through this life, and not to dismiss them as somehow in need of our service, but really look at them as really critical co-constructors of this experience and responses to their experiences. So, you know, I just want to offer that because it's easy to listen to this and get overwhelmed, but I want to encourage us to be motivated to engage with our girls rather than run away from this issue.
One of the ways that we can really engage is by becoming a mentor, because so many people are asking, what can I do? I call my congressperson, I go to rallies, I do all these things. And one of my new things is become a mentor. There are so many organizations in the Bay Area that specifically focus on low-income youth, formerly homeless youth, people of color who are trying to go to college. What do you think about that, Monique?
Mentorship is great. I think mentorship is great. Supporting organizations that provide mentorship is great. You know, supporting If you're not one who can engage with time, then and you have other resources, donate those resources to these organizations that are still increasing the capacity, their own capacities to respond. Mentorship is also, I think, an important way that you can give back your skills and network to individuals, but understand that mentoring is more than just taking a kid out to lunch, right?
Yeah.
That there are some really important qualities that need to be in place for the mentors of young people, especially those who have had a history of being victimized and exploited. And I always caution folks, you know, that there is a tendency for folks to want to respond to missing girls and say, oh, if I can be there for them, that would be really great, and end up negotiating with them in ways that further their victimization or that trigger their own trauma from their history of exploitation.
Mm.
And so I would just say that it's really important to work with organizations like Dreamcatchers, work with organizations like Missy, work with organizations that are working with young people in very direct, specific ways to increase the capacity, your capacity, if you're interested in that, to become a mentor. But I really do think that there are other ways that we can engage in this conversation, and that's having conversations with our own peer groups about this issue, elevating and centering the issue of trauma in this conversation, not participating in the erasure of black girl pain in the conversations that we have about missing and exploited children, so that we can really build our own capacity to respond and see the humanity of those most vulnerable in this work and in this space.
And
final thoughts? Yeah, well, I agree, and thank you. For instance, in Alameda County, the most critical need, of course, is beds for the youth and the young adults that are trying to stabilize. But also, I agree. I find that another thing that I wish for is that more women's organizations that are extremely well-resourced would take the time to hear a more informed and analytical discussion and then engage much more aggressively. I think that there is a disconnect that isn't perhaps conscious, but it is tragic, between many well-resourced women's organizations and the connection they have in the fight and the war with women of color and girls of color on the street. It is in fact an intersection also of patriarchy. It is in fact an intersection of permission that has to be addressed. In addition, I just want to say on the most practical level, as well as mentoring, most nonprofits, and I speak from my own, but many, are profoundly under-resourced in terms of bandwidth. So when we have people come with high skill sets that are willing to dedicate them to the organization's capacity to outreach, capacity to build funds, capacity to social media connections and education tracks, that is also really, really a significant it has really significant impact, and it is an area of expertise that nonprofits can't afford, but desperately, desperately need in order to get the larger community more educated and more sophisticated about understanding where their leverage in their response should be.
Well, if you'd like to get involved, you can find a link to Dreamcatcher Youth Services. It's an agency serving homeless and trafficked youth in Alameda and Contra Costa counties, and Umba Johnson is director. Monique Morris is president of the National Black Women's Justice Institute and author of Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. Umba and Monique, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.